You're listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
With Avasant on the Record podcast, I'm August Cole, writer in residence. Joining me today is Jim Tinsley, managing director, and Joshua Pavlik, principal at Avasant. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So we're here to talk about the Hacking for Defense course at Georgetown and your role in it. Before we do, I think it's worth stepping back and talking about the lean startup methodology that informed the curriculum and to kind of place that process in the defense context of that interaction between Silicon Valley and really the Beltway here in DC.
Sure. So the lean startup methodology is really about applying best practices from Silicon Valley as it pertains to shortening development cycles and doing things faster. And doing that in a way that leverages a lot of information and interviews and insights from the customer. So it's about putting the customer first and then using that knowledge to really shorten the way that, products are developed. And the idea with Hacking for Defense is really, hey, how can we take this methodology and apply it to really hard defense challenges? Especially now, this is a timely subject, just given that the threat environment is changing just so rapidly, and technology innovations that DoD wants to take advantage of are also changing. So there really is an imperative to shorten development cycles and do this in a way that takes advantage of deep customer knowledge.
And I think the biggest cultural difference between Hacking for Defense and Lean Startup in the current defense enterprise is there's direct customer engagement. Instead of waiting for the customer to specify a solution and set forth a whole set of requirements, there's a discussion of how do I get to a minimally viable product as quickly as possible with the lowest amount of investment that I can then test in the field and see its efficacy and get in the hands of the warfighter, rather than waiting for the customer to perfect a requirement and then waiting for a contractor to create the perfect solution for that requirement. We essentially shorten that development cycle, have more iterative discussions with the customer, and get to a solution much faster.
So in a 14-week class, not a 14-year acquisition cycle.
Correct.
That's a big change. And so how do you kind of package all this into something as small as a classroom? And talk a bit about the roles that you played in the course itself.
Well, week to week in the classroom, the idea for students is to every week come with findings, come with their minimum viable product. So right from the start, people are putting forward solutions. So that's one of the big differences from a typical development process is, you know, you're not going to wait to the end of the process to come up with a solution. Each week you're putting forward a hypothesis of what that minimum viable product is going to look like. And then to what Jim just said, you're going to iterate. So every week what we saw from students was their concept of what the minimum viable product is, and then their working assumptions of what customers want. And that's going to change week to week. And that's part of the beauty of the Hacking for Defense process is that there is that room for iteration. There is that encouragement of discovery to happen as part of the process. So discovery and product development are not separate functions. They're really one and the same. And our role in the process was to advise the student teams and really help them understand market developments that could guide their development. We gave them advice on how to think about customers, think about competitors, and do so in a way that can really push forward the development of their products. So it's a data-driven process, and it's a process that's really rooted in iteration.
Yeah, because it's hypothesis-driven, even though there's a minimally viable product every week, the student teams are not committed to that product in the same way a large contractor would be in saying, I must defend to the death this product and this specification for my competitive advantage. They're essentially looking at the range of solutions that they can offer. They're looking at the feedback that they're receiving from customers, and they're instantly saying, this is less valuable to these beneficiaries, the people that will actually use the product and benefit from the product, and therefore maybe I don't need to do or include this requirement or this feature. And so because they lack that same commitment to a product or a manufacturing value chain or something that is an extension of a current business, they're willing to explore a lot of different ideas out in the industrial community community as well as within the customer community, from anything from a software solution to a hardware solution, from a services solution to a thought process solution. And in the end, the teams were very creative at coming up each week with a set of hypotheses about what that minimally viable product would look like across all of those dimensions, rather than saying, this is the only solution and therefore I must eliminate all other competitors.
What I found interesting from the class that I sat in on was how much research was done by the students, and if they failed to deliver the requisite number of interviews, you know, for their quota for the week, the instructors let them know that that wasn't acceptable. But the byproduct of that was they were put into a position where they were forced to confront whether their original hypothesis was right or wrong. So that idea that failure or pretty big course corrections was actually normal. How did people take that when they had to switch lanes?
Well, I think human nature, that's not always easy for people. And I think that's in any walk of life. You know, you go far down that time-love continuum and then find out that what you were working on, your hypothesis, or even the customer problem is not what is necessarily the correct one. That's sometimes a tough realization. I think what you see is, as students went through the class, the acceptance of iteration and kind of changing course, people became more comfortable with that over time. But certainly that was encouraged. And you know, one of the interesting things that I saw is by the end of the class, there were really students who were thinking about just reframing the customer problem completely. And they worked with people in the Army and other organizations to really start to think differently about the original problem that they asked. So what changed was not just the student's hypothesis about the problem, but it was really just the fundamental understanding of what the problem is. And we saw some redirection there hand in hand with customers.
There's an element too, I guess, where you have to actually tell your customer that they may not be looking at it right either. Did you find cases where that happened?
Absolutely. As Josh emphasized, it was iterative, not just from the class learning and the student teams learning, but the customer learning about what solutions were out there and what their limitations were and what that minimally viable product might look like. And I think the most successful teams were those that had great engagement with the sponsors within the US DoD. Again, this was something that was very real. We want to really emphasize that these were actual problems with actual US government customers. Every week we'd go to class, there would be people from the intelligence community as well as from SOCOM and the other services who were there, who were providing advice and feedback in real time in addition to the interviews the teams were doing. And I think the more that each of those participants and the problem sponsors learned from the teams and learned from the research they were doing, that became a better iterative process than you might see in something where we say, well, we're just looking for an answer and we want the teams to get there.
What were some of the most impressive products that you saw, even in that short amount of time, and which of them do you think might actually end up in the field someday?
Well, I have to say, yeah, the one that stands out in particular was the work done by Team Spyglass, as they called themselves. So their solution, or their problem, was really posed by the Army, who basically said, hey, we need to figure out ways to monitor social media to understand a little bit more where threatening situations may arise. Didn't really give them much further guidance beyond that general problem statement. And what Team Spyglass did over the course of the entire semester was to take that problem statement and then eventually by the end of the semester turn it into a real working artificial intelligence algorithm that can essentially monitor Twitter feeds and then in real time identify, using AI, where a threat is coming up, either based on the actual words that people are posting or even through image recognition. So by the end, they actually had a real working prototype that actually generated interest from the Army. And you know, I think that's something that really has some potential there and is a really interesting solution. And it just shows what you can do over the course of a semester rather than years and coming up with a solution.
Yeah, it's interesting because each student team actually ended up creating solutions, some of which will be viable and some of which will be proven to be non-viable for different reasons. So the cross-domain solution team, Blue-Gray Berets, actually came up with a solution within 6 or 7 weeks and found a provider that could meet the needs of SOCOM. And so they essentially completed the task, but without having to develop a new product. And because of that, they ended up being retasked. But if you think about that, that is a solution that SOCOM had put forward to the class that they have been struggling with for multiple years in terms of transferring unclassified data from UASs into classified networks, and within 6 or 7 weeks, they had a solution from a vendor without having to develop a new solution and spend $1 billion. Team Gargoyle, that was doing augmented reality and facial recognition, found that the current set of glasses and goggles and other augmented reality devices didn't have the processing power to do the things that the Army wanted to do. And so they had to create a more system approach. And that, of course, then helped evolve the customer understanding of what VR devices could do. And then the counter UAS team was essentially awash with solutions that the Army and SOCOM and others were considering. And I think the only issue they ran into is that so many solutions, from EW to information warfare to missiles and munitions and everything else, kept coming up, and each kept getting tested. And so they were in a difficult position of having to keep up with a very iterative model that was using exactly the kind of lean startup approach we're using. But they were one of many, many teams that were assigned that task, not in the class, but in life. And so you saw the differences in the way that rapid acquisition can work, from let's do a rapid development program to let's find an off-the-shelf solution to let's evaluate a set of viable options and see what worked, to let's not think that Silicon Valley instantly has a product off the shelf, but let's understand the limitations and a system approach. So it's fascinating to see how every team adapted to the landscape.
And I think that's a really important point, that one of the benefits of the Hacking for Defense process is not finding a solution per se, but sometimes it's finding where there isn't a solution and coming to that realization really quickly. It's kind of a cliche now, but it's okay to fail fast. And I think this is one of those instances where the process really encourages people to fail fast and to find out what doesn't work. But in the end, that's saving time, that's saving money. That's going to be a benefit as much as the solutions.
So that's an important lesson, but also a hard one to take into a big company. But there are some really important lessons, though, like that, from the class for industry. Talk a bit about what you picked up in the classroom that you think has direct relevance kind of in the aerospace and defense community.
Well, one of the first lessons that I think is really important for industry is to really put the problem first always. And I think it can be very tempting when you have a new product or a new capability and you say, hey, who wants this? What can I do with this capability? The question that I think is oftentimes more fruitful is to go and ask, what is the customer problem? What is the customer really trying to solve? And then figure out how the technology applies. The Hacking for Defense process really emphasizes problem first. And from an industry perspective, I think ultimately that's going to save time. That's going to make things move quickly from a development standpoint. So putting the problem first is one of those big overarching lessons that I think can be applied to any number of strategic or technology development problems that industry is facing.
Yeah, I think another one is that strategic plans and product development life cycles within the defense community tend to be driven on an annual cycle. And I think one of the things that we saw in this class is that it may not be weekly within these organizations that have to do IRAD plans and government audits and the rest in terms of their development lifecycle, but it should be faster than annual, and definitely faster than 5 or 10 year schedules for development. And so what we saw is that if they were focused on, instead of justifying a 1 year development activity, but essentially iterating toward a set of solutions that could be viable and essentially starting the front end of that development process in a faster way and allowing it to evolve quickly rather than locking in on a solution early. That's something that, even as we do Price to Win or other activities at Avascent, we always recommend to our clients, is don't get locked in on a solution or approach before you have to, and make sure that you're listening to the customer and iterating your solution toward what they want, as Josh said.
And that's true for strategy too. I mean, not being too wed to an idea that you refuse to shift course when everything is telling you in the market that you should.
Exactly. You have to be willing to pivot and willing to take into account information that you see in the marketplace. So what goes hand in hand with that is having a process or a strategy process that really takes into account what's happening in the marketplace, and just don't have that be a one-year process. Always have your eyes on the market. Have that be something that you live, not something that you revisit from time to time. I would say something else that closely related to that is, from a technology development perspective, ditch the static roadmap. It's really important to be flexible where you can. I realize that's not always possible. but where you can start to make decisions or pivot before you get to a certain milestone or a certain date, I think that's going to be something that is going to ultimately accelerate development processes. So that's something that, where possible, I think it's good to revisit and think about just the way that technology development plays out.
One last thing is that even if large defense contractors struggle to implement cultural change, as we're talking about here in Lean Startup, which will be anathema to how many things are done, they can still partner with small businesses and innovative businesses that aren't necessarily in Silicon Valley, but ones that are more defense focused and are focused on generating customer ideas, and essentially, like the teams that we worked with in class, are focused on solving the same solution sets, but are more aggressive in terms of how they invest and what products they might want to bring to market. This can take out the cultural dimension of, well, I have to fit a manufacturing flow path, or it has to fit within my annual strategic plan. So using smaller businesses and more aggressive companies like this that are able to implement Lean Startup, you can do that through partnership or acquisition rather than having to do it as a large cultural imperative from the top down.
Well, this certainly portends a lot of big potential cultural shifts. One of the things I found fascinating about the class was that it was live cast, so that anybody could tune in, which is a remarkable thing when you think about a lot of the cutting edge concepts being developed. But that kind of openness, I think, is a hallmark of these approaches, and probably we'll see them spread to other corners of the industry. Well, thanks for joining us today, Jim and Josh.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
With Avasense On The Record podcast, I'm August Cole. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen to episodes at avasense.com.
You've been listening to Avasense On The Record. To learn more about Avasense, go to avasense.com or follow us on Twitter @avasense.